Hollywood delivers as Wrexham are back in the big time.
And it's no nay never, no nay never no more, cause I'll stay a while to over forever and more. And it's no nay never, no nay never no more, cause I'll stay a while to over forever.
Hello and welcome to By Far the Greatest Team, a podcast in which football fans attempt the futile task of working out who is the greatest team of all time. Sometimes, like David Beckham floating the ball over Neil Sullivan's head from the halfway line, greatness is obvious from the first day of the season. Other times, like Leeds when basking in a 2-1 victory over Wolves last August, a different kind of greatness in the form of an SOS to Big Sam is what lies in store. My name's Graham Dunn. I guarantee one Oxford United reference per pod. And joining me, as ever, is my self-appointed arbiter of greatness. It's Jamie Rooney. Hiya, Jamie.
Hey, Graham. I'm glad to be back for our new season. I'm also trying to get engaged with the Oxford United references. I'm always second-guessing where you're going to plant them so I can try and get in there before you nowadays.
Very wise. Now, on this podcast, we do like to try and shine a light on the little-known stories that crept under the radar. And this week, we're looking at the story of Wrexham, who, probably unbeknown to anyone, have just been bought by a couple of Americans and got themselves promoted. It's the incredible story of Wrexham. And helping to guide us through this story, someone will be familiar to anyone who's watched the Welcome to Wrexham documentary. It's the voice of Wrexham, Mark Griffiths. Hiya, Mark.
Hi there. Nice to be on. And Gary Briggs was the first player to be sent off against Wrexham after they brought in the professional foul red card rule. So there's my Oxford United reference.
Oh, that is already, you have already raised the bar. Gary Briggs got sent off surprisingly rarely, given how often he could have been sent off.
Well, I always remember I was like a teenager then, sitting in the stand, excited about this new rule, wondering if it would ever reach North Wales. And then I think it was a good halfway through the season because I think refs still were a bit reluctant to be doing it. And Briggs, I can't remember who it was he fouled, but he just absolutely nailed the guy. His player totally clear one-on-one, about 25 yards out. And Briggs, to be fair, was quick to catch him, to foul him. Maybe he should have committed to trying to make a tackle. And I just remember sitting there with this real sense of excitement thinking, oh, I think that's one of them. I think that's one of them professional fouls that the ref agreed. I'm pretty sure we didn't beat you, though. So that's usually our style.
Oxford did take from Wrexham the great Mark Crichton a few years ago, another true rock of a centre-back. I'm not sure he ever got sent off for us, but could certainly handle himself.
He was a fabulous centre-back for us. He came to us from you and was a remarkable centre-back alongside Mike Percival, who's been going around the lower divisions, who he converted into a centre-back. He was a winger.
A winger? And, oh, wow.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I mean, we're talking about by far the greatest team the world's ever seen. Well, Heston were managed by John Beck, the high priest of the Hot One.
Yeah.
And they nearly got into the Football League, but with a very sort of pared down version of Beck's gospel. And Mike Percival, being a 6'2" big lad who could, with a bit of pace, in Beck's view was a winger. And so they'd ping huge diagonals onto him and he'd head them into the box. Yeah, he had good feet, to be fair. When we got him, we played him for a season as a winger. He didn't really do that well. Many whole houses, but a bit limited. And then we switched him back to centre back, and he and Crichton were sensational, and the record that we still hold, actually. I was going to say we lost it last season. We got 98 points that season, and it's the most points in the top five tiers that a team's got without getting promoted, because that was the season of Vardy at Fleetwood, and we lost in the playoffs. And I was about to say that record went last year, but of course, although we smashed that record and Notts County did, we both went up. So actually, yeah, it still stands.
So we're recording this ahead of the first game of the season, which starts on Saturday. It's the start of our new season of the pod, and it's the start of the new season of the Football League. And I don't think there's a more exciting first set of fixtures than the first set of the season. Mark, any standout of Wrexham, either good or bad?
Well, I've seen a few, as you can see if you're watching this by the state of me. My first ever season. This, it's nice for me to enjoy something like their success now because I keep missing things. My first ever season was the season after what was considered to be the best season in Wrexham's history. So 1977-78, we win the third division. So we're up to the second tier for the first time ever in our history. We win the Welsh Cup. We get to the quarterfinals of the League Cup, a comfortably beaten by Liverpool. Then also in the same season gets the quarterfinals of the FA Cup and are unluckily beaten by Arsenal 3-2. And I started watching the season after. I missed all that fun when we had three players who all scored over 20 goals each when we were just the most wonderful free-flowing side. You might think I'm kidding, but I promise you I'm not. Bill Shankly was a regular visitor at the racecourse then because, it was all a bit awkward with Liverpool after we retired but then got bored and tried to go back there. And he really enjoyed watching Wrexham, and he was often at the racecourse. And so come along, this sort of excited kid, thinking, oh, man, I'm supporting the best team ever. Not least because I used to get shoot religiously, of course. Shoot reckoned at the start of the season that Wrexham were on such an upward trajectory that we'd be in the top division before long. And they suggested, believe it or not, that we should try to buy the European Football of the Year, Alan Simonson. And I remember, so I'm like, I'm about to go to my first ever Wrexham game. And I'm thinking, oh, this is absolutely, wow, how lucky am I to be born in Wrexham? First time anyone said that for a while. And then, of course, what happens? 0-0. First game of the season. Really dull 0-0 against a Brighton side with a youthful Mark Lawrenson in it. Second game, Leicester City, which actually was my first game. 0-0. Third home game, Newcastle. 0-0. And by which point I'm now starting to think, football's not as exciting. I had a pretty intimate sort of mental image of the roof from the inside because I spent a lot of the game just looking at it thinking, wow, I'm in a big building. But that was it. Three games, no goals. The fourth game, there was a goal, believe it or not. It was scored as my dad and I were walking up the steps to our seats with our backs to the pitch. So Mickey Thomas scored the first ever goal I was present for, but I didn't see it. To me, that's what the start of a season is. It's you go into it with great hope, like you say, and then all logic is defied, and it's a huge, crushing disappointment from that point on, which possibly is because I've supported Wrexham since 1978. For the last couple of years, I was only starting to think like it was worth it.
One of the things I like about the start of the season is that I think having 2-3 months off, all the players get better in your mind in that period. So you always go in with some level of optimism. And I remember Oxford, it was season 98. We had Malcolm Shotton had somehow kept us up with a glorious Kevin Francis-led recovery from the second we started the next season. It kicked off with a 2-2 draw at Bristol City, and that seemed a half-decent result. And I remember Malcolm Shotton afterwards, the line was, not many people are going to come to Ashton Gate and get a point this season. And he was absolutely right. They mostly got 3 points. They they finished bottom. They were the only team to finish below us. And that 2-2, they didn't win any of their first 10 games. And that 2-2 did set the tone, but just not a very good one.
I remember classic false dawn was our first ever game in the National League. We felt then like dropping out of the Football League, it's the end of the world, what will happen to us? Genuine, real fear nowadays is more just embarrassing that you've lost that status, perhaps. But then you really did feel like, oh, are we going to exist then? What happens? And we were in the middle of terrific financial problems. But then we played first game of the season with Stevenage Borough at home. Stevenage were the bookies' favourites to win the league. And we beat them 5-0. And you just thinking, okay, yeah. We will
walk it. Walk it.
We're going to walk this. This is going to take a 1 year party and we're back up. It was quite nice to have that confidence. I mean, the other one that sticks in my head, I suppose, if, forgive me for rabbiting on, is this season against Eastleigh. One thing which was very unusual for us as National League team was that we had a settled side because we've suffered from new managers coming in, completely ripping the team up every summer, and us having 6, 7, 8 debuts every first game of the season. There's been no stability, sometimes necessarily, to be fair. And sometimes some managers, Brian Little and Dean Saunders spring to mind, genuinely would rip the team up every window. We got 40 pros by the end of the season, sack them all. Genuinely, that happens for about 6 windows in a row with those two. I've got to be frank, it's the first time I've ever started the season feeling, not I hope we do well, but we will win the league. I really felt that. At the end of the season before, the second half of that season, there'd been a gelling with the crowd like I've never seen before. You know, and you just got this sense that the Wrexham players, they expect to win at home. The Wrexham fans expect them to, but it's not like a weight of expectation. It's more genuine, this positive sense illustrated by that crazy game that was in Welcome to Wrexham, of course, when we beat Dover 6-5, with 5-2 down after 20 minutes left. I'm a positive guy, but I'd given up, actually. I didn't believe there was any way back. But the crowd kept going. I was really struck by that. It was really impressive. And we did come back. And there was that sense. You can see the players feel so at home when they walk off on the racecourse pitch. Mm. And so Eastleigh was the first game of this season. I had that genuine sense of confidence. And we're losing with about 20 minutes left. And Eastleigh had parked the bus. And we were really a decent team, Eastleigh, to be fair. And we were really toiling to get anything out of them. We bring Elliot Lee off the bench for his debut. Bang, bang, he scores 2 goals. We've won. And I think that is the indication of what this last season was like as well. I think that was a fair indication of what was to come, that we went into matches expecting to win. We were positive. We were on the front foot all the time. To be fair to Parkinson, some fans claimed we were supposed to be negative before he came to us. He won't settle for a point. He'll gamble for the 3. Yeah, we would have won the league comfortably were not for the fact that Notts County were absolutely unspeakably brilliant, which is I despised it. They were unbelievable. And far from a rivalry, I know I speak for a lot of Wrexham fans and saying how glad I was they went up in the playoffs. So we knew what it was like the season before to just come second in a crazy title race. And I think the reason we came second the year before is because we were the only team in the whole division who had transfer windows. Everyone else could buy whenever. Because we were in Wales, we weren't allowed to that season. So Parkinson didn't complete the squad build until January. And since then, we've had a year and a half of just utter madness. And actually, it was before that window, so not the last January window, the window before. It was 2 months before that, the last time we actually lost at home. It's just, like I said, there's that wonderful sense of confidence and just this notion that, the players know it. We go to the racecourse and win. And I don't think it'll be the same next year, but that was a great first day of the season, just to set that tone, if you will.
You know, when I think about those first games of the season, one of the seasons or teams I like is the poor Norwich fans who had gone down the year that they went down to League One, and they had Brian Gunn in charge. Local rivals Colchester, Paul Lambert come to town. 4-0 up at half time, 7-1 to Colchester by the end. Brian Gunn sacked by the end of the week. Keeper never plays again for Norwich. And Paul Lambert is their Colchester manager, ends up there as Norwich's manager within 2 weeks. Very, very bizarre start to the season. Jamie, can you do any better than that?
Well, I don't know if I can do any better than that. The Eastleigh one's a great shout, Mark, because I think it does set the blueprint for what was to come. That kind of never knowing when you're beaten. The amount of turnarounds in the early part of the season that Wrexham had from being 1 goal down, with late goals as well, that belief with the blueprint was kind of set from the very beginning. I'm going to go back to 1990-91. Barnet have just got promoted to, I think it was League 4 then, actually it was called. It was the League Division 4.
Fourth tier, we call it.
Yeah, fourth tier. Sorry. So, Mark, we get really confused with leagues, so we just like to refer to them as tiers. So, Barnet have gone from the National League, the conference side, into Tier 4, which I think was called League. And quite coincidentally, that is a strange quirk that was going on in the Football League at that particular point, because the Football League had decided that they were going to extend the 92 football teams to 94. It was a failed experiment because I think Aldershot went bust, which caused the problem. But coincidentally, the season that Barnet went up, Mark, I'm sure you would know, the team that finished bottom of Tier 4 in that particular season was Wrexham.
Oh, there's no allegation. Let's experiment.
it's purely coincidental.
No, it isn't. I think that I've never had the actual, I don't know why, but I've never asked Brian Flynn this, and I need to, because I actually do think that's exactly what happened. We just avoided finishing bottom and going down the year before. Got revenge for Norwich by sending Colchester down instead. And it was a real scrap to survive. The next season, Flynn brought through a lot of young lads, a lot of them. And like I said, I don't know why I've never asked him this. I believe that was a deliberate, right, okay, we've not got any money. We're not going to, you're not going to challenge. We can't bring players in, but we can bring young lads through. And I feel there was, at the very least, an implicit agreement with the board of, we'll let you bring the young lads through and not sack you, and we'll see where we stand.
Yeah.
Because we did finish bottom. We deserve to finish bottom. But the nucleus of that team was the nucleus of the team that a year later beats Arsenal and then becomes the nucleus of the team that through the 90s plays that nice or not always rewarded football that I mentioned earlier. So if that was deliberate, it was strategic genius. I think it was. I really think it was. People doubt if I tell the truth most of the time. It's okay. It's okay in my general life. That's all right. But in my career as a teacher, it's less good. I swear to God, we lost 11-0 on aggregate to Everton, and we were the better team. Well, maybe the first leg. The first leg was amazing because Neville Southall was at his peak. And Chris Armstrong, who was really wet behind the ears, but you could see he had something. He was so quick and strong for us as a teenager. He was at a point of his career where his strength and pace got him into wonderful positions. He didn't have the composure to then settle himself and score. And the combination of those two factors meant that we made so many chances, but either Armstrong would miss them or Southall, he was unbelievable that night. And we lost it 5-0. And I just remember I commentated on it and I'm walking off after a second. This commentator's on a great performance there. Have we lost 5-0? I admit the 6-0 at Everton was maybe not so competitive, but
No, but that maybe does. It's fascinating. And you're right about obviously mentioning the Arsenal game, which is probably the last time into what's happened in the last couple of years that Wrexham had made it into the kind of the national psyche, I guess, isn't it? Everyone remembers the Mickey Thomas finish. It's an unbelievable moment. Do you presumably look back on that as a sort of high point?
It's definitely a high point, but I'm not wasting my time-travelling token on it. You'd be surprised to hear. But more of that later, I'm sure. I don't want to usurp your running order, but I got something else in mind. It was astonishing. It was genuinely astonishing. And it was just the whole nature of it. We're losing with 7 minutes left, and yet we still win it. Mickey Thomas, I mean, Mickey's lovely. He's still out of the games. He does stuff with BBC Radio Wales. He's a great character, but he's a lovely fella. He really is. He comes up the press box, and it's a tight squeeze on the press box, and he'll come along the back, and he'll punch you in the back and go, all right, lads. He's lovely. Despite what he says about it, I don't recall him taking free kicks. except, ironically, no shadow or lie, that first free kick that I had my back turned on when I was 11. He didn't take free kicks. Certainly not when he came back to Wrexham at the very end of his career. So I don't know why he took that. And then everyone forgets the winner.
Which is
rather cruel. You're Steve Watkin from Acrovire, a little village right on the edge of Wrexham. He's a smashing bloke, very unassuming, had a very good career after that, profiting from a mistake by Tony Adams. Although I'm now a morbidly obese idiot, I used to be a goalkeeper. And the best save I ever made was from Steve Watkin, which I think makes me better than David Seaman. Although, I may be slightly wrong.
I think you can claim that.
The logic stacks up, Mark.
But yeah, Steve Watkin scored the winner, bless him.
No, you're right.
I suppose Steve Watkin as well, now I think about it. The next season we got promoted, Flynn pulled off the remarkable coup of bringing in Gary Bennett, who was a Chester cult hero, not the centre-back, the striker with the receding hairline, not that I can talk. And we got him on a free transfer. He'd been pretty ineffective for Chester, unless he was playing against us, and he loved playing pantomime villain. So probably the most hated footballer amongst Wrexham fans, and Flynn brings him on a free transfer. Everybody's horrified. He scores over 100 goals in 3 seasons, including 40-plus one season. He's top scorer in the whole country. And actually, Watkin, in that first season, the promotion season, Watkin outscored him. And everyone forgets that because their relationship settled into Watkin was a very strong player with his back to goal, you know, about 5'10", but he could perform the role of a target man as long as he didn't just try and dump her on his head. And he did so much legwork for Bennett. And Bennett knew it. You know, Watkin was a massive part of Bennett's success. But again, people forget he scored the winner against Arsenal. People forget that actually in that promotion season, he outscored Bennett.
I'd sort of forgotten. I do remember Brian Flynn always playing very tidy football without necessarily, during that period, Wrexham never hit huge heights, but were pretty solidly a reliable. I remember, I think it was probably in that period that Carl Connolly seemed to be scoring most times he ever played against whenever he turned up. He was a great player. And without ever kind of doing anything spectacular, Wrexham were pretty solid over that period. But then it starts, I guess, to go a bit sour kind of the mid-2000s. Is that about right?
Yeah. I was just trying to deny reality for a second, but I'm going to have to face up to it. But it sort of went a bit sour initially because of a lack of money. Flynn was, I mean, my personal opinion, I feel he was nudged towards the door a little bit. Some fans felt that perhaps he'd had his time. I think that's a little harsh. The board certainly appeared to keep transfer funds from him and then make them available once they got rid of him. So he started the season unbelievably with two teenage goalkeepers, both of whom looked promising, neither of whom made anything of it really, probably because they were thrown in as teenagers in a weak team. And genuinely nobody in the entire squad who has ever played a first-class match as right-back. And it was openly said, Mike Stowell was going to be the new goalkeeper. Oh, the deal's pretty much done. Jim Whitley is going to be our new right-back. Oh, the deal's done. They've trained with the team. And then both those deals suddenly, no, they're not happening. And I think that was a case of Flynn's got a contract and we don't want to keep him, so we're going to make life difficult for him. Because we brought Dennis Smith in then, and Jim Whitley came. And you think, okay, you had no money for him. They said we couldn't afford any more players. But the problem was, we were now hobbled with a poor squad, and Smith, who was terrific, couldn't get a tune out of them that season, and we got relegated. So I think it's partly financial, partly shooting ourselves in the foot. And that then sparks more problems, because ultimately we then have the first of two takeovers, which are very bad for the club. I'm measuring my words very carefully. I don't want you to get sued. If you were a bit better, maybe I would try and get you sued. But I mean, a brief summary of that was that we were bought, it seemed, by a failed owner of Chester. But then we get promoted. And we get promoted 2003, playing the most wonderfully attacking football, and you got the sense that Smith took a look at the fourth tier and thought, this isn't much good, let's just attack it. Because these play three at the back, our two wing backs were wingers, no two ways were. Carlos Edwards.
He was a good player, Carlos Edwards.
He was a lovely player, he was. But he was playing as a wing back. Which I think, to be fair, he sort of settled into after that, but he was an out-and-out winger until Smith converted him. And then on the left, Paul Edwards, again, an orthodox winger, liked to take people on, put good crosses in. He certainly hadn't played wing back either. And they were both magnificent, but I think it was part of us being a bit gung-ho. It didn't stick at first, didn't work. We lost 5-2 at home to Rochdale. I remember questioning reality after that match. We've got the ultimate talismanic striker, Lee Trundle.
Oh.
All the tricks, all the skill. And the story of us getting him is peculiar in itself. The guy who until that point had looked like the willing workhorse, Andy Morrell, who turns out to be the phenomenal striker. Yeah. And in that season, I'm saying about Bennett and Watkin swapping roles. I mean, honestly, I love Andy Morrell. I can't tell you how much I love Andy Morrell. He joined us when he was 24, having not played sort of at any level of professional football at all. Stayed in university. He was a terrific hard worker. He scored crazy goals for the reserves. He scored crazy goals in this weird competition, which was basically created by the BBC called the Welsh Invitational Cup and then the Welsh Premier Cup, which we kept winning and he kept scoring crazy goals. He scored 7 in a game against Merthyr Tydfil. But then in the first team, he tended to work hard and not really get anywhere in terms of goals. But then the next season changed. Trundle yeah. becomes the hard-working water carrier, and Morrell scores 40-odd goals, and it was ludicrously good. So we do bounce back up. The trouble is that this owner isn't the owner. It's actually the guy who, you know, made his appearance on Welcome to Wrexham, Hamilton.
Yes.
And so the original guy, Gutterman, he wasn't the owner and told nobody. And when Hamilton comes in, everything goes very pear-shaped, very, very quickly. It's the only good thing you can say about that really is that's why we're in the situation we're in now. That collapse into the National League turned us into a sob story. Seeing that happen to us definitely played a big part in Rob McElhenney's thinking when he's looking for a club. You know, that we've had misfortune after misfortune. I'm not trying to whine about it, because like I said, if we'd just done what we've been doing all along and bombed between third and fourth tier, they would have bought somebody else.
Yeah.
And I used to say after the Arsenal game, anyone who's been through the 80s of Wrexham, when the 10 worst average attendances in our history were the 10 years of the 80s, and has been watching us playing Hartlepool in front of 900 people on a freezing cold night, in May. it's like out of here. Arsenal was our reward. You earned that. And I think that in a funny way, not that I wanted to stay in the non-league for 15 years, but this is the reward now. And I think that's why alone naturally there's a lot of jealousy and criticism, but I think a lot of football fans get it as well and think, oh, okay, this is genuine.
I think it is in football fans' nature to look enviously and begrudgingly over at clubs that have far better, nicer and richer owners than you. Good friend Martin Middles for a fan, and I thought, why have they got Steve Gibson, who seems to be like the best, fairest, most reasonable, seems to give managers time, give them money. No one could begrudge that Wrexham hadn't, Wrexham fans hadn't earned, as you say, in the conference. You had several, you've been made the playoffs four times, didn't you? And obviously as the season, I think you referred to earlier, the one where you get 98 points, finishing behind Fleetwood. I mean, that's a tough break to not get. And it's such a difficult league to get out of because, of course, only one team goes up directly.
And that's a farce. So, speaking now, I'm in the Football League, I would still argue for three up, three down. No question. Yeah. Or even four up, four down, with the playoff place. Because it's just so obvious over the years. You see strong sides in the top 10 of the National League. Partly, the old Football League teams that have regenerated like we did, but also some good teams, well-run teams within the non-league that have now been in the Football League. And they've got nowhere to go because it's a bottleneck. And then you look at the bottom end of League Two and you think there's some stagnant teams there that maybe would even benefit from being flushed out and coming back up again in a more equitable system. You know, even though now we're the right side of the trapdoor, I will never change my opinion on the fact that you need to have normal relegation and promotion, not least because the National League is very different from what it was, say, about 18 years, 20 years ago, when teams like Darlington and Colchester would drop down, be far too good, and go straight back up again. It's very different now. There's a lot of big teams. There's a lot of teams that will spend beyond their means to try and compete because they think if they can actually make it, all of a sudden they're in heaven and it's wonderful. So there's an awful lot of depth of quality now. It's no longer the semi-pro league below. In fact, I think, because Altrincham went full-time last year, I think by the end of the year, but there were only two part-time teams, I think, in the National League.
Yeah. I fully support the idea, Mark. I think it's a fantastic idea. And I think with the story that Wrexham and Notts County have created in the last few months, I think there could be some argument, a solid argument for it. But the Football Association's always been deeply suspicious of non-league teams. I mean, it was only in the late 1980s that they abolished the election or re-election process, which was a bit farcical. It was very rare a team would get elected to the Football League. Generally, it would be the club would maintain the same 92 members. And even when they did bring in the single promotion relegation from the National League, as a non-league team, you had to hit a particular criteria. That wasn't the case for teams that already existed in the 92 that failed that criteria, but were happy to keep their membership. So I think the FA have always been suspicious of the non-league, but I definitely think there's a shift change in that now, Mark. And I think Wrexham have contributed to people seeing the National League as a very different league. I mean, it's got a television contract.
It has a television contract. I'm not sure how good a deal they made of BT. I think it was more BT said, oh, we'd be quite interested in, and that was as far as the negotiation went. And then they found their arm had been snapped off. I don't think it's a particular... Well, you get 24,000, isn't it, if you host a game? 14 if you're an away team. And if I'm wrong, I apologise, but I'm pretty sure that's it. But yeah, but I agree, though. I mean, it gets a lot of coverage. And I think Notts County and us and Stockport the year before have been really good for that, because it's been an actual narrative that people have been interested in. But having said that, I do think that narrative has helped people to pay attention more to the National League. And it's a good standard now. Us getting that amount of points, not counting at that amount of points. I would argue we are two League One teams in terms of quality. Not saying we're guaranteed to go up again at all, but in terms of the quality of players, certainly we've been looking to bring in. We've been looking to bring in players who do well at League One level.
Yeah, the quality is definitely there. I mean, if you look at the last 20 years of the National League, the 40 teams that have been promoted, not one single team has gone straight back into the National Leagues. Now, some have gone back into the National Leagues over time, but they've been able to establish themselves in league football. Of the 40 teams, 20, I think it's 27 of them are still in the Football League right now playing, and the majority of them that aren't are in the National League. So you've got that yo-yo effect. So I think the quality is unquestioned. I think the quality from the National League into League Two is incredibly narrow.
You know, thank you for reminding me of re-election. Goodness me. You know.
We covered Heritage United, the 71-72 team. I think only five teams over that 40 or 38-year period, they were one of the teams that got promoted, or elected, I should say, and they didn't even finish top of their league. They finished runners-up in their league. So they hadn't won their division, but they still went on to obtain league status. It's a sign of the times, I guess.
I can't get on my high horse over that, because we regularly profited from the fact that English teams were allowed in the Welsh Cup, but they couldn't represent Wales. So if we got to the Welsh Cup final against an English team, we were in Europe the next year. My first ever season, I was Wrexham. Like I said, we lost over two legs to Shrewsbury, who were very much the new Wrexham. They sort of did what we did the year before, won the third division. They got a good cup, FA Cup run, if I remember correctly, and won the Welsh Cup. But yeah, I can't complain about that.
Wrexham went all the way to the quarterfinals, didn't
they? That's before my time, but that's the team which is the foundation of that great 77-78 team. That side had some fantastic players in it. Billy Ashcroft up front, who's a massive target man with a big ginger afro. People like Arvon Griffiths, who's played the most games ever for Wrexham. He played Welsh international manager when we went up in 78. He played people like Mel Sutton, who was just like non-stop working all the time. Gareth Davis, who was a rock-solid centre-back. You know, Joey Jones started to come through then as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Key Thomas, you know, these were wonderful players. And then they added a bit more on top the year they went up. And then after that, I started being able to watch us in Europe. And yeah, it was fantastic. Arsenal come third in my... I'm not giving away yet, but Arsenal come third in my time travel token. I was toying with it being Porto. Because 1984, we were terrible. I mean, genuinely terrible. We've had terrible financial problems. We bring the manager in, Bobby Roberts from Colchester, who's a good man. But we said, you know, we've got no money publicly. We have no money. And Bobby Roberts brought young players through at Colchester. And so he's good at working within the budget, all those cliches. Yep. And that's why we're bringing him in. Now, poor Bobby, fair play to the fella. He gets us relegated and then relegated again. I don't blame him, because it was like, it's good to say, yeah, we need to bring young players through. So bring a bloke in with a reputation for that. But for goodness sake, we had no plan B. It was all right, Bobby. We've got 11 players and a lot of children. Make something of it. You know, what could he do? So we end up in the fourth division. We were bad, really bad. I mean, now, if I can just bore you with some stats.
Boring
people with stats.
That's my role in this whole thing, is to bring stats.
That's your role.
You're in my...
Well, in that case, grab a little bit. We start the season, lost 3, drew 1. Then we actually win 2 games. Then we lose at home to Peterborough 3-1. Our next game is at home to Porto, for goodness sake.
You know, it's already good.
That's the Portuguese national side that have just pushed France really hard in the European Championship semi-final. 3 years later, they won the Champions League. We attract less than 5,000 to watch one of the best teams in Europe because we are just so down on our backsides. And we beat them 1-0, incredibly. I think a lot of it was just that, I know it's a cliche, but it's true. A lot of the European sides played proper football, and then the British sides would knock you around a bit. And I really don't think they coped with it well. So that's remarkable. So then the league. So you think, right, we've just beat Porto. Surely now you'll see the quality of the side coming through. Mm. So we lose 3-0 away to Crewe the next Saturday. Mm. We lose 4-3 at home to Stockport the Saturday after that. And then we go off to Porto, knock them out of Europe. And then we go to Torquay and we let in 4 goals. We beat Tranmere, then we lose 3-0 at home to Northampton. Then we lose 1-0 to Mansfield. We lose 2-1 to Hereford. We get a draw against Hartlepool. I mean, are you seeing a pattern here? Darlington, we lose. We lose at home to Wigan in the Cup. Southend, oh, we lost at home to them. 5-2 loss at Scunthorpe. How the hell did we beat Porto in the middle of all those results? I mean, that's just breathtaking.
That is genius.
For me, that is the great upset for Wrexham. Yeah. Bar none. But that was a terrible Wrexham team. And the manner of how we knocked them out as well. Because that 1-0 home win, it was great. Mm. But you just think we're going to get spanked
when we go to Portugal. Yeah, yeah.
And we do, basically. After half an hour, it's 3-0 to Porto. Now, I don't know where that I was listening to it on the radio at home, you know, and there's no full game as far as I can find anywhere. But I don't know whether Porto just thought, well, this is over now. But we scored 2 goals in the last 5 minutes. Our right back scoring from 2 corners. So it's 3-2, and we're winning on away goals. So Porto throw everything at us again. Mm. They score again. And then in the closing minutes, young Barry Horn. Ooh. If you haven't seen it, it's worth looking it up on YouTube. An amazing volley. The ball's coming like shoulder height. And he just sort of hurls himself. It's not a sort of Mark Hughes... You know, you can see it's the classical, you know, if you're going to make a sculpture of a sort of scissor kick, it's going to be the Mark Hughes goal at the racecourse against Spain. You know, it's not that. It's, I don't know, improvised, beautiful, lucky, I don't know. But he just sort of hurls his body upwards at this high ball and somehow volleys it across into the top corner. It's a remarkable volley. And, yeah, there's no time for Porto to come back because Wrexham do... last-minute drama. That's our sort of thing.
There's this great history. I mean, that's the great thing of this Wrexham scene. And you can see that's obviously why Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney get... That's one of the things that brings them to this team. Mm. I mean, what sort of state were Wrexham in before they came in or on the eve they came in?
Yeah, I mean, I won't go back too far, but the truth is that the story really begins with that takeover I mentioned before. We very nearly go out of business. We are rescued from that remarkably because the owner, Hamilton, tries to... He has an issue in that. He gets rid of a lot of the board and he has a four-person board. Him and Gutterman, the guy who we thought owned the club.
Yeah.
And then he kept 2 Wrexham fans as directors because I think he thought that they would be patsies and not stand up to him. But they were wrong. He was wrong. They did. So he didn't have majority on his own board. So he brings in a motion at a board meeting to appoint his own PA. The 2 Wrexham fans say no. Mm. He has a straw. And I've got the photo of this. It's beautiful. He scribbles on a Coca-Cola cup memo pad his resignation, throws it at them. Maybe that's me adding a little bit of flourish. And storms out. Now, of course, this is a fatal mistake. Because they immediately put the club into administration. He's lost control now. And of course, as you will have seen on Welcome to Wrexham, I'm sure you're aware anyway, when it's investigated, the administrators immediately find they feel they've got a case for Hamilton acting illegally, and they're right. They're proven so in court. He's removed. The local consortium that buys the club then appears to be rescuing it. And I do think initially, their intentions were good, but circumstances change, one of which being that the main member of the consortium sold his travel agency for millions to Thomas Cook, but he took an awful lot of it in stocks rather than cash. So he's an extremely rich man up until the point when Thomas Cook stopped.
Thomas Cook.
And so I think that changes his circumstances. And as a result, that ownership then turns toxic. And a remarkable rogues gallery of potential owners are put up and are scared off one way or the other by the fans, who are remarkable and become incredibly politicized to the point where, in the end, the only option is to sell to the fans. The supporters trust ran the club. As far as I'm concerned, they are magnificent, the people who ran the club. But some of the fan base, I don't think a majority, but a vocal minority, started to become disaffected because they felt we'd be trapped in a National League forever. I don't think we would have been. You know, we were consistently one of the top two or three best-supported clubs in the division, and by logic, surely, there can't be a Fleetwood every year, and that will count for something.
Yeah.
But the trust wanted to operate a break-even approach, which I applaud. And I mean, my attitudes, maybe I'm a bit too easy to please, was that I've just seen my football club nearly stop existing twice. It wasn't a nice experience. And now we are run by people who will definitely keep this club alive.
Yep.
They committed to buying the ground, which meant there was a big lease to pay every year. And so I think some people blame them then, saying, oh, we should spend it on a striker. I don't agree again, because until the club owned the ground, we were always vulnerable to people coming in to try and buy the ground and, you know, knock the stadium down. Yeah. So I think the trust were magnificent. There were times when we got close to getting promoted. I've got to say, Dean Keats, who was replaced by Phil Parkinson, I have a lot of sympathy for him. That team the season before, who were at the start of the Welcome to Wrexham series, that was a decent team. He had a good eye for a player, and he was a good organiser. He knew non-league football really well. He knew the people within it, and he struck some really good deals. And he'd gone, this is his second spell with us, he went to manage Walsall. And I think that only developed more his knowledge of the market, if you will. He brought some really good Football League loan players in as well. And I personally, at the time, felt I'd like to see him given an opportunity to operate with money. He had very few fails in the transfer market. We missed out on, it was really horrible, we missed out on the playoffs on the last day. We'd been in the playoff positions all season.
Yeah.
And then the last day, I mean, I don't know, to be fair, whether it was the occasion, I don't know, but we really played poorly at Dagenham. We're losing 1-0, the player sent off. And yet we equalised with about a minute left. And then had a 3-on-1 break in added time. You're thinking, just stay calm and roll it to him, and surely. I didn't.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the exact figures, but I did do a calculation beforehand, a probability tree. How many different combinations will see us miss out in the playoffs and you know, the different results in the last day of the season? And it was something stupid like there was only a 6 in 85 chance based on combination results of us not being in the playoffs. And we got one of those. Six. And it was really a shame. And I think Keats wasn't ever going to go. And I've got to say, I mean, I can hardly say it wasn't good to bring Parkinson in, because he has been outstanding.
Mark, I was going to ask on Parkinson, do you think that was a kind of a sign of the reflection of the ambition of where the football team saw itself? Bringing a manager with a good reputation in league football, done some really good stuff with some, you know, League One, League Two clubs, and incredibly took Bradford City to the League Cup final in 2013. Do you think that it was a statement of intent more than a reflection on Dean Keats?
100%. You're quite right. They brought in people like Ted Reed, who was a FA Director of Football. They brought in Sean Harvey, who was the EFL CEO. You know, that from that sort of well-versed basis, if you will, they look for somebody who was high calibre. There's no question it is. There's no question that Phil Parkinson's reputation helped us to bring in the sorts of players who normally wouldn't go to National League. Ironically, and I'm not blaming anyone for this, it might be the thing that stopped us going up first season, because Parkinson wasn't appointed all that quickly in the summer, which is natural, because you've got to convince someone like that that coming down to National League's worthwhile, and you know, having everything filmed is going to be worthwhile. And then, so we went into the start of, I remember I went to the first day of pre-season training, and we didn't have that many players. We hadn't brought many in at all. I think we only brought in two or three.
Oh, wow.
But then the thing is that soon after that, Mullin comes in. And I think that was important, because that was the statement player to say to players, actually, this is serious. This is not just, there's going to be lots of talk about it, but it won't be a big deal. They've just bought the best player from the division above, who would be playing two divisions higher. I think, and that was a major moment. But that wasn't that far ahead of the first game of the season. And that's why I said earlier that we needed the January window that season to actually complete the team. But Mullen was the follow-up from Parkinson. Parkinson says, this is serious. Yeah. And then Mullen says, this is really serious. And then all of a sudden players are looking at this and thinking, yeah, okay. But I mean, Tolza, for example, didn't sign till after the first game of the season. So, you know, you've got to work at players like that, haven't you, to convince them that dropping down is the right thing for them.
Yeah. Did Mullen stand out right from ball one? I mean, he obviously comes with a massive reputation and he's in like the form of his life, isn't he? I mean, he's suddenly hit this unbelievable golden patch. Massive signing, but huge expectation when he comes down there, isn't there?
Absolutely. You could see straight away it was terrific. We played one home friendly because we had to relay the pitch against Macclesfield. Macclesfield had been reborn by then. They're a few divisions lower down. So we beat them 4-0, I want to say. But you could see Mullen had character in that game as well as quality. You know, you don't want to judge him against lower division friendly opposition. But just the way he was loving having a good crowd behind him, you could see, he's up for this. And then his debut at Solihull was a terrific game where we go behind. And really, first 50 minutes were very passive. And he's sort of thinking, hang on, is this how it's supposed to go? And then he concedes. And then, Mullen just comes to life. He wins a penalty. Something we've now realised is typical of him. I mean, fair play to the book. He's obviously very talented. But my gosh, he puts a shift in. I mean, the guy really works for the team. And he chases a lost cause. And with his pace, turns it into a 50-50 with the keeper. And the keeper takes him down. And then he takes the penalty in the grand style by sprinting up and launching it into the roof of the net. And
he's just straight away, doesn't he?
This guy likes the occasion. But having said that, the first half of the season, he didn't have it all his own way. You could see it was quality, and he did score a fair few goals. But as Parkinson says in Welcome to Wrexham, he needed someone to take the strain off him. We brought in Jake Hyde from Southend, and in pre-season, they looked fabulous. Yeah. Hyde, very much a penalty area target man slash striker, who wasn't that mobile, but was a good fixed point. Yeah. And then Mullen just running both channels either side, could finish with either foot. Mm. And it looked lovely. But in real football, it didn't work as well. And Hyde wasn't as dominant. And also Hyde kept picking up injuries, which, you know, I had sympathy for him. But he wasn't quite the level maybe we needed. I liked him. So he used to get into these great six-yard box positions and then shin it past the post. So when we brought Palmer in January, Mullen really flourished. And there are some crazy stats, which I haven't got to hand. As a partnership, their record the second half of that season was jaw-dropping. You know, the amount of times in home games, there was something mad, like they had like sort of something like 17, 18 home games that they played together, started together, and both of them scored in about 14 of them. And that sort of lunacy, you know?
Yeah.
So, Mullen was terrific, but maybe every player needs the right partner, don't they? And that really was what helped him to kick on. And then last season was just insane, you know? You just see him at Sheffield United and you're thinking, these defenders will be in the Premier League next season. And they were really scared of him. Ahmed Hodic, I mean, he's a great centre-back, he was wonderful. But in the second half of that match, he was terrified of him. He kept backing off him all the time. He gives away a penalty with like a wild hack on him because he's just, he's passing me now. What do I do? And he's just thinking, this guy's class. He was in the Championship 11, wasn't he, for the season? But Mullen melted him. It was beautiful.
He's such a talisman player for Wrexham. You talk about Palmer as well. Is there anyone else who came in who doesn't maybe get picked out in the same way, but is just as important?
It's fascinating because the first time ever, we've got such strength and depth now. Last season, essentially, we had a team that looked good enough to play, like I said, about two levels higher. And then Parkinson kept bringing in good players.
Yeah.
And you think, well, where are you going to fit these in? And then players who had established themselves and proven themselves as being terrific found themselves on the bench or not even on the bench. So to take an example, Luke Young, our captain, tremendous person, tremendous player, wonderful ambassador for the club, great choice as captain. You know, he's played about 3-4 years for Torquay in National League. then with us, he's been with us, what, 5 years? But yeah, at the moment, he's fighting to get a place in the starting team. Also in centre midfield, although I think people do appreciate him, but he's not a headline grabber. We brought in James Jones from Lincoln in Parkinson's first summer. I think it took a while for people to fully appreciate him. But yeah. Goodness me, I mean, that guy, his stamina is terrifying. And it's frightening how he keeps going. I don't know. We played a pre-season last summer in the middle of a heat wave at Nantwich. And, you know.
Well, that's already the most extraordinary statement anyone has said.
Heat wave in Nantwich was a cracking nightclub, I'll have you know. he was just added time. We're winning 5-2, and it's a friendly. It's your first friendly of the season. Mm. You know, I mean, firstly, does anyone care? No. Yeah. Secondly, it is one anyway, and he's just constantly in added time. He does 3 or 4 sort of 20-yard sprints for balls he can't reach, just because it's like a Labrador or something. He's going to run all the energy off him. You know, I'm belittling him saying that. I don't mean to. His work rate's outstanding. He puts out fires without touching the ball because he gets back quickly into position, and he never tires of doing that. The teams break away, but Jones gets back in position, and they've got to look elsewhere then. And I think the sort of things people don't notice so much. I will say as well, I've got a great deal of respect for Parkinson because once he got his proper team together, you really started to see well-grooved patterns of play. And you sort of thought, this is a good coach. These players have got automated movements in certain parts of the pitch. We're not robotic. We can extemporize. We've got players, you know, players like Elliot Lee and Paul Mullen are all about the flashes of inspiration. But you know, they're also got a good basis to work from. And that's what, you know, Jones doing that is clearly something that's worked with. You know, we've got players like Anthony Forbes, right wing back, who's a midfielder slash wide midfielder, really. Oxford.
Yeah, I love him. He's a fabulous player.
And he can go inside, he can go outside, he can do anything he wants down that right flank. Mm. But then Jones is also bombing past him into a terrific position. And these poor fullbacks, hang on a sec, but I've got to cover him, but if I go and cover him, Ford's going to shoot from the edge of the box or play a brilliant pass or cross. Ford's a fabulous player, and yet he's another one who's under real pressure for his place because we brought in Ryan Barnett from Solihull, and he's a proper straight-line winger, and he's a really good winger. But that's a good example of the strength of depth he got, where to me, if there's a better wing-back in the National League than Barnett, it's Ford. You know, that's the quality we got.
I suppose the extraordinary thing about that season in particular is that in any other year, you'd have been doing a Fleetwood. You'd have just walked through, you know, record points ever in that league. You know, it is almost as if, I know it's a cliche, but it is almost as though Hollywood has scripted it in some way because the battle with Notts County and, you know, to have two teams that go through, you both lost like 3 games all season. You both got on these like, 20 plus unbeaten runs. I mean, North County end up with like this. Don't they end up with a positive goal difference of something like 77? have a proper rival there.
They were phenomenal, and really, you won't get anything but the deepest praise for them from me. They were horrible. I hated them so much because any normal season we'd have won the league by February. But then, like you say. It must have been a fix. Some people, I think, genuinely believe that, you know, that somehow this was fixed for the next season of Welcome to Wrexham. I think genuinely, do you see people? I know social media can strip irony away, but I do see quite a lot of fans who are not, you know, following Notts or Notts County, talking, oh, that's a bit of a funny coincidence, isn't it? They seem to be genuinely sniffy about it. I mean, you can't bribe all 24 teams. Come on, we haven't got that much money.
But it's not Italian football, is it?
absolutely right. I tell you what, you haven't visited the suitcase quarter of Wrexham, have you? Notts County were just relentless. I was really confident that we would have to burn them off at some point. We kept winning and winning and winning. And I just thought, you know, I mean, fair play, they're brilliant, but they've got to start faltering. And they didn't. You say about Hollywood scripting it. Well, I mean, firstly, Welcome to Wrexham is a major plank in the whole business plan. Mm. We get money from it and we get supporters from it. So we're in Offaly County. Season two would have been a sort of fun procession to promotion with no tension in it whatsoever.
Yeah.
And probably a lot of emphasis on the cup run. Whereas instead, you've got an absolute barnstormer. And then, I can't wait to watch the Notts County episode when we play them at Wrexham. You know, I mean, seriously, not even tripe like Ted Lasso would dare to have a penalty in the 96th minute to make it a draw, which the player spots up. And then the wind moves it off the spot. So he has to re-spot it. And then he takes it. And it's a good penalty, to be fair to him. And it's saved by the bloke who's come out of retirement, the ex-England keeper who comes out of retirement to finish his career where it sort of started 15 years ago. And even then, I don't know if you've seen where the slow motion's on it. He saves it with both hands separately. Because he saves it with his bottom hand and it flies upwards. So heaven knows if it had gone up and actually gone in. By fortune, because he's dived with both arms, it comes off his right arm, up onto his left hand and ricochets away. Could have ricocheted in. I'm looking forward to that. I mean, you can't make that up. I'm so looking forward to my commentary if they use it, because my commentary is used on the matches now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there's a lot of screaming. And then, you know when you completely lose your mind and you maybe don't quite make sense? I got really excited because the ball ended up on the building site behind the goal. And I started obsessing about this because there was like 5 added minutes and it was the 6th minute when the penalty's taken. And so I'm sort of, the ball drops loose and one of our players thumped it because they demolished the cop by then behind that goal, thumped it into the building site. And I was so desperate to win. I was sort of thinking, that will waste time. Maybe they won't let them take the corner. And they're going, we've kicked it into a building site. We've kicked it into a building site. I reckon that might get trimmed out myself. I misidentified the player. I was so excited. I was just in a blind rage by then. And they should have scored from the corner. Elliot Lee headed it off the line. No, everyone forgets that.
Imagine that.
Saved the penalty and then the corner goes in. Oh,
yeah, I see. There's so much, sorry, Graham, there's so much in that to unpick. And I just want to go back to the relationship between Notts County and Wrexham that season, because you mentioned the incredible unbeaten runs. I think by the time that when Wrexham lose to Notts County early on in the season, I think it's 1-0, Wrexham then go on this incredible 28 unbeaten run, 28 games. It's incredible. It was such a long run in a competitive league. In that period, they're top of the league. I think they stay top of the league for 7 or 8 games. They then lose their first game against Halifax Town for 28 games, the 29th game, and they go second in the league. It's just incredible. You would think 28 unbeaten run, and it's mostly victories. You've kind of banked a few points away that you're going to be safe. We can lose a couple and still secure top spot. They lose it immediately. It's absolutely fascinating.
It just goes to show that maths is a cruel mistress. I mean, we had a game in hand then, which was the thing we were clinging on to, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But nonetheless, I mean, they were utterly relentless, Notts County. Utterly relentless. And I hated them for it. But I do love the thought, and I'm not saying this from a scripting point of view. I do love the thought of it feels like we're upwardly mobile, County feel upwardly mobile, and Stockport feel upwardly mobile. And I do quite like the idea of this sort of free-headed rivalry continuing over the years as we try to push on. Because the Stockport and Notts County games now are games that, you know, we're really obviously looking forward to. There's an edge to it. When we played both those clubs, I don't mean a nasty edge, but just, you know, there's always been terrific away support.
Yeah.
There'll be great fixtures, they will.
Yeah, it does happen. I mean, Wickham for ages, they're probably still their big rivals in many ways. So Colchester, I mean, they're obviously Oxford are a far bigger team than Wickham, but I'll let that go. But Wickham and Colchester have had this massive rivalry, and it was entirely built on these two these kind of again head to head challenges going through the conference. And you're right, and you would expect all three teams to be up there or thereabouts. I mean, Stockport already were right there last year. You would expect all of them to be, over the next couple of years, sort of challenging and probably moving up the leagues in the same manner, I guess.
the late season games we've had against them have been quite something the last couple of years. I mean, when we played Stockport the season before last, you know, we had two home games against them in the space of a couple of weeks. And in both those games, just like Notts County does, they showed their quality. Mm. But we still won. FA Trophy semi-final where Mullen, I'm pretty sure his first goal was the 90th minute. It's a brilliant, tense match. And Mullen scores the most fabulous, I mean, ludicrous chip from about 25 yards on the left wing. Phenomenal goal. And then, as we seem to have a pattern of something happening, but it's been overshadowed by what happened before, in added time, he scores a ludicrous goal and no one remembers it because everybody was still in the ground going, oh, did you see that chip? They knock it long. Liam Hogan's under it. Mullen muscles him off it, which he's tremendous at doing. He's only a little guy, but he's very good at levering centre-backs off the ball. And he's one-on-one with the keeper. Keeper comes out, and it's like right down the middle. He's around the penalty spot. Keeper's coming at him, and Mullen somehow gets the perfect flick up over the keeper, but only just behind him. So he's not like lobbed him. He's deliberately flicked it over the keeper, run past him, and then half volleys it in. And it goes a heck of a long way up. I mean, it's such, when you see it and see it from the side, you think it's like some sort of circus act the way he's doing this. it was him, you know, securing a place at Wembley and beating our rivals. And then in the league, we beat them 3-0 and real again. They came at us, our keeper made some good saves, and then we had a really sort of high-powered comeback to them. So you know, all these games already are stuck in your head. The Notts County away game you mentioned that we lost 1-0, it gave you a real sense of these two teams are above the rest. It was like sort of Fraser Ali. It was two heavyweights just going at each other. It could have been 6-6 easily, but our keeper, Mark Howard, was brilliant. And we squandered some easy chances. And how it was only 1-0, I don't know. But even at that early point, you think, ooh, this is, these are good. But you can see we are as well. You know, it whetted the appetite. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to those matches.
You said it could have ended 6-6, and bizarrely, a number of Wrexham games did virtually end 6-6. I mean, there were a couple of mad games that year, wasn't there?
Oh, Dover. Dover was insanity on every level. Yeah, every single level. I can't remember, it is in the documentary. Dover had scored something like 4 away goals all season, and it was March. And then they scored 5 at ours. And it was over after half an hour. Well, no, that's not. We were 2-0 up after, 15 minutes, something like that. They were 5-2 down with 20 minutes left, and the crowd stuck with them. It was astonishing, that. It was genuinely just ludicrous. And the final goal, I mean, nobody in the press box had any clue as to who scored it. When you look back at it, it's so clear. But I think everybody was so high on adrenaline that nobody could properly see what was going on. And I remember the classic press box thing of people just shouting up and down the bench, "Who scored that? Who scored that? Who scored that?" No idea. I was really pleased when the commentary they used on Welcome to Wrexham, because they included my mate Andy, who's been commentating with me for years. Because after that game, I thought, oh, that's the sort of thing that could go viral. Yeah. And I sent it in to the club. The club used it, but they trimmed Andy's bit off. And it was Andy's bit that I thought was the good bit. Because basically the ball goes in, and I just like scream and scream and scream. And that's the bit in the Welcome to Wrexham of the sound meter. Actually, Andy's screaming as well. If you listen to it, you can hear there's two people. He's screaming too. But then when it finishes, he's got a very dry manner, a very dry sense of humour. And when I finish streaming, he just waits for a beat. And he goes, "In case you were wondering, Wrexham have scored." And it was just perfect. And they kept our in Welcome to Wrexham. I thought, well done. I'm delighted, because he deserved the credit for being so dry under such exciting circumstances.
We're going to get to ranking the team in a minute. But the bit which must be fantastic for you to see, having been at the racecourse, and the racecourse is this incredible, long, historic ground, you know, and actually, when you look at how many clubs have changed ground, moved grounds, you know, all these bits and pieces around it. But to see the ground full, you know, the attendance is just, I mean, it's just ludicrous, isn't it? I mean, it's sold out every week. It's given where Wrexham have been and where you have seen them and been going That must just be incredible, mustn't it?
Oh, it's fantastic. Like I said, when we played Porto, we got less than 5,000 fans.
Mm.
It's ludicrous, isn't it, really?
Porto.
It really is fabulous to see. And it also gives me a little bit of sort of sucker in the sense that I'm sitting there all cynical. Fleetwood, well, they've bought the league, haven't they? You know, bringing Vardy is not fair. and then the year before, Crawley, well, they've bought the league, haven't they? You know, they brought, you know. And now me, the hardened fan, should run football clubs, people who receive money are evil, bloke, is now trying to justify we've received money. You know. But what pleases me in that regard is that, yes, we have bought success. Although, to be fair, ever since football began, success has been bought to some extent or other. But what's pleasing for me, and I suppose why I was a bit sniffy about some other clubs, I was worried about the long-term sustainability of, I mean, to give you an example, a Neath in the Welsh League outbid us for a player in our second season. We had Christian O'Leary, old Swansea defender, Welsh international, at the end of his career. He came to us at the end of our first season in the National League, and he was solid. And we wanted to keep him, and it seemed he wanted to stay until Neath made an offer, which we couldn't compete with. And you're thinking, Neath are in the League of Wales, but they were very heavily backed. They also had Trundle. Trundle trained with us, and the club had to go on the record saying, he's only training with us. There is no way on earth we could meet his wage demands. He went to Neath as well. Thing is, they were massively pumped up by a rich guy, and when he lost interest, Neath was gone. Because you can't sustain that. Likewise, sadly, Russian and Diamonds. What I used to worry about Fleetwood and Crawley and Forest Green, they're a benefactor, but their crowds don't really go up that much. And you think, well, you need to quickly establish yourself as something bigger than you've been before, or you could get into trouble if that person drops out. The good thing with us is that people often say, oh, well, the way you spend money on players, what about financial fair play? I don't think financial fair play is an issue. Because the owners played it very smartly with the sponsorship deals, for example. We're getting crazy sponsorship deals, and the profile of the people who were sponsoring us, with the revenue coming in from the Welcome to Wrexham and different things like that, but also because it has reawakened a football town.
Yeah.
Who are now getting, every game is a sellout now. And, you know, one of the few things people do complain about is the fact that it's a hot ticket. There are ticket touts who sell Wrexham tickets. I mean, like you say, me as a kid watching Wrexham play in front of 950 people, tickets out. So you had to walk through the yards to see someone's program. So it's this sustainability. I mean, they're building a new cop stand. We open the start of the season after this one, and it'll add another 5,500 onto it. And it'll be really interesting to see if we are sustaining this momentum, whether that still won't be enough.
Yeah.
But that's, you know what I mean? It's not a case of someone coming in rich, but you're still getting 1,200. It's a case of somebody revitalizing something and then everyone's flocking to it. So that feels, that's the good part of it. Like you said, the crowds are fabulous. I didn't think that the crowds would take off like this. It is fabulous. Just as a little practical aside, the headphones are used for commentating. I always used to have one headphone on, one headphone off, because they're really good at insulating sound and you can't hear the crowd properly.
Yeah.
Now, I always commentate home games with them both on, and I often can't hear the commentary because the crowd noise is genuinely up a hell of a lot of decibels. And really, that is something there. But the crackle in the atmosphere is fantastic. And before the big games, if they do the Welsh anthem or something like that as well to stir people up, which you have to get special permission for, by the way. So we don't use it. You know, we're not able to just bomb every team with it. But it really raises up the atmosphere. It's quite something.
Oh, it is brilliant to see. It is brilliant to see. So we are going to rank this great team. But how great are they? So we have five categories of greatness, which run from right at the top, the all-time greats, through to through true greatness, touch of greatness, to edge of greatness. I'll get there in the end. And then we have blink of grace at the bottom, which you won't need to worry about for this one. Jamie, maybe I'll start with you. Where do you, what's your take on this side?
Well, I feel we've only scratched the surface with our time with Mark. I think there is so much to cover. There's so much that I had to cover that we've not even got into. But I mean, it's been absolutely fascinating, not just to kind of get the feel of the emotion of what's happened in the last couple of years at Wrexham, but before that with Mark as well. It's clearly, you know, has lived and breathed Wrexham his whole life. And it's a really tricky one because we like to talk about legacy on this. And all we can do with this Wrexham team, the 21 through to 23 team, is project what we think that legacy is going to be. And I think we've got a Field of Dreams moment here. I think, you know, if you build it, they will come. And I think what Wrexham have done, they've created something that may become a template. Now, we're all used to English football and owners coming in from different parts of the world and buying up football teams. But that generally happens in the Premier League. And that's always been the case. That has changed. That is changing right in front of our eyes now. I think what we're seeing with Wrexham is that there are possibilities, untapped possibilities. So I think the legacy of Wrexham is not just going to be for Wrexham. I think they're going to spread something across the whole of the football world, not just in England. I could see this template going elsewhere in other leagues that are growing, but definitely English football is the hotbed right now. I mean, in terms of ranking them, because that's what we need to do, I definitely foresee as well that former European Footballer of the Year, Alan Seamonson, potentially the likes of those, could sign for Wrexham in the very near future. I mean, he signed for Cheltenham, who were a league tier two team at the time anyway, so it wasn't such a wild dream. But I think, you know, the types of signings that you could probably only ever dream of as being a Wrexham fan before this moment could become possible. And I think they will have a successful season in League Two. I'm going to absolutely love watching the rivalry with Stockport County and Notts County. So where do we rank them? I think this is, I feel really awkward with this because I think there's definitely a case, listen to Mark, that they're, you know, they're right up there as an all-time great or a true great. But I'm going to be, I'm going to chance my arm here and hope I get away with it and I don't lose a new friend in Mark. I think they are absolutely prime and perfect for the edge of greatness. I think that's the bracket they are. I think we are on the edge of greatness right now with this team. We've had an amazing journey with Wrexham, and I think we're going to see more. So maybe we come back in a few years and they get promoted from edge to touch to all time. I'm going to kick off, Graham, as I like to, and I'm going to put them into edge of greatness. And I always lose, so I accept that that won't be the bracket they finish in.
What about you, Mark? Record that. Your number, Jamie. Choose your words carefully, Don.
What do you reckon then, Mark? How does this team stack up?
It goes last. So be careful.
Well, you know, Jamie, as the Dandy Warhol said, we used to be friends. Actually, I'm going edge of greatness as well. I mean, I want to be in the spirit of the podcast, and I know that Wrexham is a slightly odd situation in the context of your podcast. You're looking at how great teams are. We are a fourth division team. And so I think actually what you're saying, Jamie, is exactly how I see it, that there's a potential here for us to do something genuinely significant, but we haven't done it yet. So yeah, I genuinely agree that this is a team that could become something amazing, but we haven't achieved that. Off the pitch, you're quite right. I think we're trailblazers. One of the regular questions I try to ask people, when you know, people who know what they're talking about, have you ever seen a business model like this for a football club? And I've yet to have anyone come back and say yes, because essentially the celebrity is currency. You know, Roman Abramovich buys Chelsea, but he's not going to get TikTok or United Airlines on their shirts because they're not excited about hanging around with Roman Abramovich. You know, I mean, you wouldn't want to share his tea anyway, just in case. You never know when you might fall out with Verba. But this is, you know, I could hang out at Deadpool. It's something very different from just high net worth people coming in and buying clubs. It's something. It's something more. I don't know. I don't know how to define it because I don't think there is an example of anyone really doing this worldwide exactly like this. And they've made a lot of shrewd choices. And you're right, they've made a template. Now, some people will follow it and it'll be a great success. Some people will follow it and not understand exactly what they've done and blow it. But their humility when they've come in, things like that, it's something interesting. And it's something at the moment fairly unique. I know you can't be fairly unique, right? Unique or you're not. Fairly unusual, I'm going to say. So, yeah, edge of greatness. Totally agree.
I think that's a very reasonable view. And the plus side that we have is we do a end of season promotion relegation where we revisit all the rankings you make and we can move them up. I say we stick with the edge of greatness, but if Wrexham go up this year, which is not at all impossible, then I will move them up to touch of greatness. How about that?
We're coming for you, Reading 1980-81.
So I accept that. So Wrexham, edge of greatness. We have one last bit of business we like to do before we wrap up, and that's to offer a sort of time machine opportunity. Give people a chance to go back. And sometimes we do multiple teams and you go across the few, but I think with this whole story of Wrexham, I think one of the things about how great this team is, everything that Wrexham fans have been through over the years. So if you had that opportunity to go back to a moment, a game or a team, where do you want to go, Mark?
I want to go to the racecourse. There's a shock. You know, 1990, we are in danger of dropping out of the fourth tier. It's the season before when we actually do finish bottom of the fourth tier, but there's no relegation. It's us or Colchester, and we look pretty doomed. There's only one team going down. We are bottom by about 3 or 4 points leading into the game. And it just does not look good for us. Colchester, well, they come to us and keep it tight. 0-0 at half-time. Real edginess. There's a real sense of we've got to win this to have any chance. Second half, just before the hour, they go ahead. I can see it still now, partly because I'm in a time machine. They get a big, sort of terrifying, you know, those sort of lower division centre-backs that look like two centre-backs welded on top of each other. And they never have hair. He had one of them called Marmon. And he just gets up and plants a header on the corner from about 15 yards out, back across the keeper, and it's a goal. And you're thinking, right, we're losing now. There's half an hour left. This is a poor team. We're stuffed. But then we get an equaliser. Gary Worthington, Frank Worthington's nephew, equalises. And you say, okay, we're okay here now. 20 minutes left. Let's go at him. 2 minutes later, we had a goalkeeper, Vince O'Keefe, and centre-back, Nigel Beaumont, both perfectly sound in their own right, but for some reason, they just didn't get along. Again, Ali and Frazier. And the ball comes through. Beaumont, I think, rightly leaves it for O'Keefe. O'Keefe stands there, doesn't come for it, and an opportunistic Colchester striker slides between Beaumont's legs, taps it with his toe through O'Keefe's legs, and we're losing again. And you're thinking, okay, it's over. We're going to non-league. And then the miracle happens, the moment which proves that God is a Wrexham fan. Because, and again, you know, people think I'm a storyteller and I make stuff up. I promise you I don't. There is the most enormous snowstorm out of nowhere. It comes over the top of the Tech End where the Wrexham fans congregate now. And it's a gale blowing into the face of the Colchester keeper, who ironically is on loan from Nottingham Forest and is future Wrexham legend Andy Marius.
Oh, wow.
And the wind and the snow blows in and they can't get out of their penalty area. I remember Marius trying to throw the ball out and he couldn't throw it out of his box because the wind was so strong. Obviously, they're penned in. We're battering them. Andy Thackeray, who was a midfielder who failed for us, he got converted to, well, he got put on the transfer list, but then was converted because of injuries into a right back and suddenly started scoring goals from right back, even though that wasn't, in those days, right backs didn't really venture forward as much. He gets the equaliser, and then last minute, Gary Worthington scores again. The snowstorm has won the match for us. We stay up, poor Colchester go down, and where are they now? Nobody knows. I'm going to pick that.
I love it.
That's fantastic.
I love it.
That's fantastic.
Mark, it has been absolutely wonderful catching up with you, and fabulous the update on it. I mean, I do think the Wrexham story is an absolutely wonderful. Obviously, people can totally stay up to that because of the documentary. And I think this season, even with the injured Mullin, although I suspect Wrexham will pull a rabbit out of the bag before the start of the season. I think there'll be another big name or two coming in, but I think it's going to be a strong season ahead. And I'm looking forward to seeing more of it on the documentary of the year to come.
Yes. Well, I'm in it more in season two, but hopefully that won't damage the viewing figures too much.
I think the documentary is just been fantastic. And the whole story is just, it's like somewhere, there's a hint of fairy tale and there's a hint of the absurd, but above all else, it is a surreal thing. But I think the way it has been put together and the spirit of which it's been put together and the kind of the respect for the club and the supporters and everyone involved, that's the bit that comes across really well. And this is a football club which has been, it has been through the mill, which has had like a dedicated support for years and years and is enjoying its time in the sun. And long may that continue.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And like you say, the last thing you would call the owners is big time. The genuinely humble guys who are nice fellas. And that's a really nice part of it, really. Yeah. And the way that they've immediately been very self-deprecating, saying, you know, oh, we call it soccer. We've got to make sure we don't do that. And talking about being custodians of the club, you know, they made a lot of binding promises in the takeover to the trust about things they would never do to the club as well, which I think spoke to an understanding of what's important to fans. Like, you know, just things like colours, names of the club, moving ground unless the fans consented to it because it was necessary.
No danger that Wrexham would be playing in blue then, unlike the
Exactly. That was a very peculiar one, that, wasn't it? Yeah, and they don't turn up looking like Bond villains in leather gloves at matches either, like that same club's always tends to. So, yeah, we're happy with our guys. And they've also, I'll tell you what, speaking of PR coups, one of the, you know, those fun, daft little things that football fans love about their club is the Wrexham fans always brag. And I'm not quite sure what the basis of this is, that we have massive floodlights. This is a big Wrexham thing. It may be based in the fact that when Chester moved to their new ground, the floodlights were on the roof. And so we were like mocking the fact that you have no floodlights, we have massive floodlights. But I said Chester. Am I allowed to swear on this?
I said Swindon last week, yeah, so you can do it.
But I mean, the thing is that they announced they were going to replace the massive floodlights. And that could be a PR disaster, although they don't work very well. They did some midweek games last season. Honestly, it was a bit dark. They've replaced them with even bigger floodlights. And I just think, you know, they've not said anything about that. You know, they've not made any direct reference to it. But of course, that's got to please Wrexham fans. The only reference was in the story on the website. It said, we'll be removing a massive floodlight. But we're replacing them with massive floodlights. And these things, we've got three of them up at the moment. There'll be four by the start of the season. They're terrifying. They bend, like on the cricket grounds, they bend over at a sort of 45-degree angle. It's cute PR, isn't it? If you're going to replace it, you've got to make sure they're even bigger than before. Fair play. We live in bizarre times.
Definitely so. These have been surreal. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, Jamie. Thank you, as ever, for your time this week. That's all we have time for this week. You can find us on the social at By Far The Greatest Team. And if you've enjoyed the podcast, please like, review, subscribe, tell your friends, all that kind of thing. And we will see you again soon.